This is Jim Semivan, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and joining me today as a returning guest after probably two and a half years to the podcast. He is a researcher and author, back for his second appearance, Warren Ijus. Welcome back, Warren. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Andy.
Very good to have you on. I believe you're based out in Malta, am I right?
Yeah, in Malta, yeah.
Lovely island of Malta. Tell us a little bit about Malta for the listeners further afield who may not be aware of where it is.
Island in the Mediterranean, hot most times. That's basically it. Not much to do, though.
Listen, I visited Malta twice when I was a kid. I probably mentioned this last time, I don't know. But I went to Popeye Village, where I filmed the Popeye movie with Robin Williams back in the day. If any American listeners are further afield remember watching Popeye with Robin Williams, it was filmed in Malta. Is that still there? Is that still the attraction?
It is. It's a big tourist attraction, yeah.
Yeah, they've still got the full set where it was filmed and they built it and the houses and they put on the shows. It's like a smaller Disneyland, folks.
Yeah, a much smaller Disneyland.
Yeah, but I remember that quite fondly from being a child. But listen, it's good to have you, Warren, because it's an international phenomenon. It's a worldwide phenomenon, and it's good to have those other perspectives. When you were last on, now it's like I say, it's been almost 3 years, so some folks newer to the podcast won't have heard you before. Yeah. Your first work you wrote was Evidence of Extraterrestrials. But let's find out a little bit more about you first. So, who is Warren Ijus and why are you involved in the UFO topic, Warren?
Basically, I've been interested, like many listeners and many of us, since I was quite young. And basically, I had read Alien Agenda by Jim Myers, and it was a fantastic book. But I realized, are these things genuinely happening? And from there, I started sort of reading up on the internet, and I was writing down a lot of notes for some reason. And then after many years, I realized, first of all, this phenomenon is very interesting. It's a worldwide phenomenon, so it doesn't just happen in the US. And I had pretty much had enough information to write a book about it. But I didn't want to write a book that, you know, I wanted to write a factual book. So what I did was, I picked one of the most convincing UFO cases, and basically using Air Force declassified documents, eyewitness testimonies, I gathered them all and I wrote my first book, Evidence of Extraterrestrials. And that book just focuses on the most compelling, most significant UFO sightings. Some, the majority of the listeners know about, Roswell, others may be less known. So it's quite an all-rounder about UFOs. But as I wrote that book, I told myself sort of there's another phenomenon that I'm very intrigued by. I'm quite skeptical about, but it would be interesting to read more about, and that is alien abductions. Mm. Of the get-go, I was quite skeptical, right? And as I was reading about it and researching it, I realized that the majority of cases are a hoax. For example, first, not to mention any names, but you know, you start reading about, you know, Billy Meyer, George Adamski, and while they are very interesting cases, even in a storytelling sort of way, I do think that these cases sort of shed a bad light towards the alien abduction phenomenon, because amongst these cases, there are a few genuine, compelling cases. Like I said, some many people know about Betty and Barney Hill, Whitley Strieber, Mary Tervis Walton, but then there are also some cases which are lesser known, like the Kentucky abductions, Robert Taylor. So I use the same approach. I wanted to approach the topic, the subject, with an open mind, without a predetermined notion, a predetermined idea. And I gathered enough information once again to write a sort of a follow-up book. And the idea was, when you combine the two books, you sort of have a good all-rounder about UFOs and alien abductions. We'll talk about it, but I want this to be sort of clear that the majority of alien abductions are would be a hoax, you know, but there are a few that are genuine and they are compelling. And those are the cases that I decided to write about, which is what my second book, Close Encounters, is about.
Yes, and for those on YouTube, you'll see Close Encounters behind me, exploring the mysteries of alien abductions. And Warren's other book is actually behind that, in the pile somewhere. I often get quite a lot of messages about what books are in the pile. So if people have that question, send it over. But yeah, Warren's books are in those, and you can search for those on Amazon and whatnot as well. Malta as a country is pretty small. As you say, it's an island in the Mediterranean. What is the consensus about the UFO topic in Malta? If you ask your everyday Maltese person in the street, what are they going to say back to you?
I think, interestingly enough, many people don't really talk about it or don't necessarily think about it. But lately, with obviously the hearings, ever since I noticed the shift from 2017, back when the Tic Tac Nimitz footage was released, I sensed a shift. Nowadays, people are not ashamed to sort of talk about it. Before, it was quite a hushed topic. People were not really bothered. I mean, people, you would mention UFOs and people would immediately think about green little men. But nowadays, people, you can have genuine conversations with them. And, you know, the second people start saying, oh, no, they start ridiculing the topic, you can easily say, listen, top guys with high-level clearance are testifying about it. And so there has been a shift, most certainly.
Have you had any of your own sightings or experiences out in Malta?
I have not. And I think even if I were to have, I'm quite skeptical as an individual. And it's ironic when people tell me, have you seen? And I would tell them no. Like, and even if I did see a UFO, I would be very skeptical.
Which is very good. That, Warren, that is a good thing, yeah.
Like, there's so much stuff in the sky, it can easily be misidentified. So, but I've spoken to people, interestingly enough, in both in the army, who have had sightings, but things in Malta are not as, open as they are in the US. I filed many Freedom of Information Acts here, based on cases I know have happened, because people, direct witnesses, told me that they experienced and made a report. But there's absolutely no public access to them at all.
Is there any famous cases in Malta that we maybe don't hear about? Is there any kind of well-known sightings over the years or decades?
Over the years, no. The one sighting there is, it happened a few years back, and it was actually a submerged object. Malta's basically surrounded by water, and it was basically a couple of fishermen who were out in the sea, and they saw an unidentified submerged object basically come out of the sea and then shoot up in the sky. But there's not much information about it. I couldn't find any. And it happened quite a long time ago.
No, that's fair enough. And I think the USOs, those submerged objects, are going to become more popular as the year goes on. And at the end of the podcast, we'll talk about next year and maybe some of our thoughts. But Richard Dolan has a series of books coming out. Folks may have heard him say that it was going to be one book. It's now a three series of books, because he's got so many cases and so much information. And I think that'll really shine a spotlight on that USO aspect of this phenomenon. Which is very much, for me, linked. And I wonder, who are some of your... And actually, let me ask first, Warren, how old are you?
I'm 25.
25, you're so young. You make me feel really old. Most of my guests on the podcast tend to be older than me. But what I loved, and I remember when I spoke to you first time round, something that really surprised me after the interview was your enthusiasm, your knowledge, the kind of passion for the subject. And that really comes through when you talk about it. Not that other folks don't have it, but it's maybe something that's overlooked, is new blood, new voices, new perspectives in the topic, to even look at older cases and look at things we've talked about so many times from a different viewpoint, with a freshness, with new ideas. And I think that's really welcome to the topic. And that's something I really enjoyed from the first time we spoke, Warren, and we've always kind of kept in touch since then. Who are some of your sort of inspirations from a research or writing standpoint?
Well, the one person, first of all, the biggest inspiration for me was I would have to say Jim Morris is the first person I read. But then Jacques Vallée, his books are absolutely fantastic. And the fact that he brings in the consciousness element to it, I think it's crucial. You cannot discuss the phenomenon without discussing spirituality and consciousness. But then I do read all the contemporary books that have come out. So I think being a loyalist towards any one author or towards one any viewpoint can be quite a disadvantage. Sure. I'm very open to say, I thought I knew this, I was completely wrong. I think it's very good to have that. But I try to read any contemporary books that come out. I mean, Lou Elizondo's book was absolutely fantastic. So I do try and keep up with all the new material that comes out.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to be. And people have maybe heard me say a few times now that I'm always open and I always try to listen to everyone's opinion on the topic, no matter if I go into it with a bias of I don't believe this person or this is ridiculous. Right now, I'm in the middle of watching Darcy Weir's latest documentary, The Cosmic Con.
Yeah.
And you're going into that. I don't know if you've seen it yet or just heard of it, but
just heard of it, yeah.
It's really interesting because it focuses on the Gaia TV channel and its early years, and it largely focuses on like Corey Good and those types of figures. I've not watched the second part yet. I'm going to get to that, but myself and Dan have both watched it, and we're going to record like a kind of members only show on it. So if anyone's signing up and using the free code, just a little plug, that kind of stuff will go on members only because it's more speculative and opinion based. Yeah. You're not going to learn anything except our opinions probably from this kind of stuff. But there are folks there like Corey Good talking about some of that secret space program and but some of the claims these people make and the sheer numbers they brought in and how they had to keep getting more and more. I'm happy to listen to that stuff, but I'm also happy to say this is utter nonsense. I don't believe this person.
Exactly.
That's before it's proven false in a court of law. And it's really interesting. And I'm always open to hearing. I've mentioned Andrew Basiaggio, who is the guy who talked about time travel and stuff before I started the podcast many years before. I heard him talk about being friends with Obama when he was a child and going to Mars and traveling time. Yeah. Do I believe it? No. Is it a fun story? And is he a great auditor? Yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I like to look at all these different opinions and wild theories and ideas and make up my own mind. And I think that's really important, like you say, to not be wed to one idea because you never know tomorrow. That one person who is your hero and everything else lets you down.
Exactly.
And where do you go?
This made me think of Billy Myers' case. You know, originally I was convinced that this guy was legit, and he could be for all I know. But like his photographs are fascinating to look at, and I still to this day just go up and look at them. They're fascinating pictures. But then, as more information comes out and his claims are quite absurd as well, the more I realize that maybe it's not what he says, you know, but that's why it's good to have an open mind. And, you know, people should not be so scared of being wrong, ultimately, you know.
I'm wrong all the time. So if I had any fear of being wrong, I wouldn't be doing this. It's that's why I like to ask the questions and share my opinion, folks. So let's get to the book then, Warren, Close Encounters. In the book, you say early on within that introduction, disclosure is continually happening.
Yeah.
So what makes you think disclosure is, I'm guessing, a process we're going through?
Indeed. I try to stay off Twitter, you know, because it's not the healthiest place to be. So I do not stay up to date the most. But I we know with the hearings happening, people were quite disappointed. They were expecting more. But we wouldn't be having this discussion 10 years ago, we wouldn't be considering the fact that we're having whistleblowers in Congress. So that's a big win. And that's why I say we should not expect disclosure to be this one big event. We shouldn't expect disclosure for military personnel to come out and say, we've made contact. That's not going to happen. I mean, I hope it does, but I'd like to think, but it's probably not going to happen. So if we look back from the times of Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book, to the times where we are nowadays, that's why I say that disclosure has been happening continually. We're now having military footages. I mean, I 10 years ago, we wouldn't have, you know, the Tic Tac, the gimbal footages. We wouldn't have had that. And we certainly wouldn't have had whistleblowers either. And now these guys are testifying in Congress. So each time I talk about disclosure and people ask me, when do you think it will happen? I always say it is happening right now because we're having this discussion. We're having this discussion on national and international basis. And that is what disclosure is. If you look at, you know, the definition, it is the revealing of information. And that's exactly what is happening.
I would much rather, like you say, have hearings to be disappointed about than not have anything at all.
Exactly.
I think there is a balancing act to be played where if it was year after year, for the next 5 years, we get the same sort of hearings that don't really go anywhere. Yeah. That's disappointing. That doesn't have an impact. But I think there is a benefit to keeping the heat on, keeping people's feet being held to the fire a little bit. Yeah. Maybe Congress don't quite have the power they would like or hope to have to get things done they want to. But is it hindering the process? I don't think so. Is it helping? It's more likely to help than hinder. I wonder, you mentioned there about, you know, you don't see any military figure coming forward and, you know, disclosing, you know, the old White House lawn alien reveal.
Yeah.
What's the most likely contact scenario you can see playing out? How do you think this is going to go down?
I personally do think that contact has been made, and I do think there is contact. I think it's a matter of it not being disclosed, which, fair enough, on a level of national security, I think I doubt whether it would be a good idea to come out and say, listen, we have contact and there are these aircraft which are more advanced than us and we absolutely cannot keep up with them. Although we know it's happening on a national security level, I do think there are reasons why full disclosure isn't happening. Do I agree with them? No, but there is a reason why. I do think that contact has been made. I mean, I look at the information that's coming out in Congress, I look at the footage that, you know, they're saying that this is just a snippet. So I wonder what higher quality footage there is. I do think that the information that we will probably have will come from whistleblowers. For the simple reason that I think that the government's job is to maintain its power. And if it's going to come out and say, we have these non-human entities, they are more advanced than us, that is a sudden loss of power immediately. And we're not even discussing the ontological effects that will have. I mean, on a spiritual basis, I mean, you know, many of us who were brought up many of us, I say, in regards to Maltese people, were brought up quite religious. So we're brought up believing that, you know, there's one God and he created man to be the most advanced species there is on the planet. And in the book, I do quote the Genesis because they do say that. So what will happen on a spiritual and ontological, on an ontological level where we're saying, actually, mankind isn't the most advanced species there is? Suddenly, what will happen to religion? Will it maintain its power or will it lose the power that it's maintained for decades and centuries, you know?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. Probably another discussion for another day at this point. I bring it back to the abduction phenomenon. I think the abduction phenomenon is perhaps the scariest aspect of the whole UFO topic, because it's the most intimate aspect of the topic, whether it's positive or negative for the individual, and that's something we'll discuss. The idea of abductions classically is that an ET, an alien being, finds you in a country road somewhere or your home, takes you on board, and you either get the, we're going to take you to our planet and you can explore the theme parks. You can go to Popeye's Village and the Pleiades, right? Or you get the scary one where you have a really horrible experience. You know what? Yeah. You mentioned Whitley Strieber earlier. He is someone who has claimed that he was raped by aliens and has as medical proof of that, which is horrific. It also spawned 1,000 memes and the famous South Park episodes back at one of the very first, if not the first episode, Cartman gets an anal probe.
Yeah,
that based off of, it literally came into pop culture, like it or not, in a big way. So there's so many different ways to go with the abduction phenomenon. Mm-hmm. What is your take on what is an abduction? What makes a true abductee's experience for you? And also, can I add, is it purely physical, or do you think there is a spiritual / consciousness aspect to it?
So in the book, in the introduction, I write that there are three examinations which I find a common denominator. So I looked at all at the abductions, and I thought to myself, if I squeeze these abductions together, what is the common denominator? And one of them is the experiments. And obviously, there is the physical nature of the experiments. There is, for instance, you know, Strieber, as well as the Hills, they mentioned that they have been physically examined and samples have been taken. But people fail to look at the emotional and spiritual experiments that happen as well. And I believe that a big part of the abduction phenomenon is that these beings are somehow interested in how humans process emotions, particularly fear and anxiety. And I substantiate this argument by saying that these entities, they elicit fear. For instance, Strieber said that he was shown telepathic images of his son dying, even though his son wasn't dying. Many abductees say that they are shown telepathic images of natural disasters. And of course, it could be a forewarning, but these beings are continuously eliciting fear and anxiety. And a part of me believes that this is because they are interested in how humans process these emotions. Apart from that, there's also the spiritual part to it. And, you know, when I interviewed Strieber for the book, I asked him, you know, what's this got to do? Is it physical or is it spiritual? And he said that it's got more to do with the spirit rather than the human body. And I believe that to be true. Like I said, like humans, we have, if we look at, you know, all the animals that are on the planet, as far to our knowledge, we're the conscious beings. And I do believe that that is it's a big magnet for these entities to take us. But looking at an abduction, I do believe that there are quite some tiers to them. And Hynek, he developed this scale. And in the book, I focus on the third close encounters of the third kind and fourth kind. The third kind, there isn't an abduction, it's just a close encounter. And here we're talking about the Socorro, New Mexico, we're talking about the aerial school landing. There isn't an actual abduction. But then the fourth kind, close encounters of the fourth kind, it's when a non-human entity, and I use this interchangeably with alien. It's when a human being is taken without their consent, and then they are returned to where they have been abducted from. And what's interesting is that each abduction case, it follows the same sequence. First, the individual sees a UFO, then they are immobilized, they are paralyzed, they cannot run away, they cannot scream. For instance, Charlie and Calvin from the Pascagoula UFO, they reported that feeling of paralysis. But then there's always some form of experimentation. And interestingly enough, when the human beings are returned, they're more often than not, it's in a state of amnesia, which Bud Hopkins used the term missing time. And from a psychological point of view, repression of memories is there when an individual experiences some form of trauma. So I do believe that the brain would be protecting itself and protecting the individual from these memories coming up to the conscious mind. And many times these memories are retrieved either through dreams or through hypnotic regression. So there's always a similar sequence.
How do you start to compute and put together the abduction experience, but so many people share entities and craft and experience, but there are so many subsets under those. So you will have different craft, different entities and different experiences. Do you think, and this is purely speculation, and I'm asking you based on your research and patterns and whatnot, do you see anything to different species following a pattern for this? It's almost like, it sounds ridiculous, I suppose, in a way, there's an agreement that this is how you go about one of these experiences, because it's very similar. You're taken on board a craft, they do some experiments, or they show you something telepathically, physically, whatever it may be, and then generally you're returned.
Yeah.
But the experiences differ so much, don't they? That it makes me wonder, are entities in some kind of contact with each other?
Yeah, yeah. The way my simple brain can understand this is like there are different. I would assume there are different races, and I say this not with I don't just throw that comment around, but if I'm going to mention two cases, there is, let's look at Betty and Barney Hill, and they describe the common grays, right? So I'm sure your listeners are aware, it's like the typical humanoid, short, massive head, massive eyes. But then we look at the Pascagoula, Charlie and Calvin, and the entity they describe is significantly different. And I urge the listeners to Google right now what the alien looked like in the Pascagoula encounter, because he was over 6 feet tall. They described him to be wrinkled. And their encounter is significantly different as well. Whereas Betty and Barney Hill stated, Betty stated multiple times in her dream journals that, you know, she somehow knew that there wasn't any malicious intent. Calvin and Charlie were significantly traumatized, especially Calvin. So the way I understand it is that different beings perhaps have different purposes, and these different purposes are portrayed through the different experimentations that they put on the abductee.
So take me through, you've mentioned a couple of cases, some of your favorite cases. I'd love to, if you want to talk about well-known ones, great. But are there any particular cases that are less well known that perhaps really surprised you in your research?
Everyone knows about Betty and Barney Hill. But the one case that genuinely stuck with me, and I had to stop multiple times in writing it, was the Kentucky abductions. And the Kentucky abductions happened in 1976. And it was different to everything I had read and written about. And basically, there's these three women, Mona, Elaine, and Louise, and they're out having a meal at night. And as they're driving back home, they see this strange light in the sky. But the strange light, first they assume it's either a meteorite or else it's a plane about to do a crash landing. But then the red light, it suddenly starts maneuvering erratically. And there's also this spatial awareness. What I mean by that is that the light starts moving in relation to the car. So if the car makes one move, the object makes a move to mirror the car. And suddenly this disc, it moves close enough for them to decipher that it is a disc and not just a light. And they described it to be bigger than two houses combined. And suddenly, Louise, who was driving the car, she loses complete control over the car. She stumps her foot on the brake pedal, but the car is maintaining its momentum. It's still moving 80 miles per hour until suddenly they lose consciousness. That's the last thing they remember. Actually, the last thing they remember, the car filled in with a smoke fog-like effect. And that's the last thing they recall. The next thing they realize, it's an hour later, and they're 8 miles away, multiple miles away from where they're originally supposed to be. So they have an hour and a half, around an hour of missing time. They have these burn marks. They're feeling these burning sensations. Their eyes are throbbing with pain. So they go back. They spend the night together. And the first thing they do is that they ask their neighbor, one of their neighbors, for help. And he notices the marks as well. And they also start noticing some malfunctions. For instance, the watch on one of their hands was moved. The minute hand was moving just as fast as the second hand. Apart from that, each of them had similar burn marks in the same regions, especially the face and the eyes. So they called their local Navy station, and they make a report, but the Navy doesn't take it seriously. So they decide among themselves, let's just drop it, and that's it, basically. But after a few days, supposedly the Navy leaks the information and people start calling them and asking them, but at no point do they talk openly about it. As a matter of fact, they refuse to talk about it. That's until they get into contact with APRO, and basically they supply financially a means for them to get examined. Interestingly enough, first they Mona, one of the ladies, goes under hypnosis, but she's in such distress that she's absolutely cannot go through her memories. The last thing she can recall is that there's this fog-like effect, and she becomes extremely distressed. In the meantime, their health, both physical and mental, deteriorates drastically, to the point that one of them said that I'm scared for the two other women, and I'm scared they're not going to make it to the end of the year. They become chain smokers, and they start experiencing depressive symptoms. 6 months in, they undergo hypnosis. And I'm leaving out details, obviously, just so I can sort of make it in a... I'm just mentioning the important parts. 6 months after the incident, they undergo hypnosis again. And they all describe the same thing. They all state that they were captured. They were put in separate rooms, and they were subjected to the same experiments. And basically, the experiment was that these humanoid figures, the same humanoids that we describe of the typical aliens, they poured scorching liquid all over their bodies and all over their face, to the point that during the hypnotic regression, the therapist multiple times had to stop the session because they were hysterical, and they had to even grab their necks in pain. One of the women also described the second experiment, which she was subjected to, and basically that they placed this material around her neck, and each time she tried to talk or she tried to think, this material would basically suffocate her. And that's the last thing they recalled. But interestingly enough, their lives did not improve at all. Louise had a parakeet, and I'm not saying this is a direct... there's a direct correlation, I'm not saying that, but before the incident, the parakeet, well, he had a warm demeanor, he was very open, but after the incident, he became hysterical each time she entered the room, and each time she left the room, the parakeet would relax. And a few weeks after, he died for no apparent reason. Apart from that, they continued to find mechanical anomalies in both in the vehicle that they used at night, but also in their watches. And essentially, they did not talk about it up until their death. I mean, they did write one article, APRO, about it, and they published it in The Examiner, I believe, but they didn't write any books about it. There aren't any documentaries about it. The only time they did talk about it was one of the women talked about it when the other two women passed away. So there isn't a lot of information about the case because they did not want to talk about it at all. It had affected them. And it was very detrimental to their physical and mental health.
I'm just going to mention APRO, you've mentioned a few times, is the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. Yeah. I was just making sure I got the name right. And that was started back in 1952. And that was an organization where you could report these things to. And there have been very, very few of them over the years. It's a really interesting case. There's a lot of classic hallmarks of abduction there. Was there any commonalities the three individuals shared, any reason these three women could have been targeted, may have been targeted? Something I always get asked about by multiple listeners are things like blood type or any genetics similarities.
That's a very interesting question, but there isn't. I wonder that too now. I wonder if there is some common denominators in their genetic makeup, in their blood type. I'm not aware of any, but it does make sense for their... I do not believe that, you know, people just get abducted randomly. I mean, a few weeks ago I read this, I'm not sure if it was Lou Elizondo talking about it or someone else, but, you know, where they notice a physical change in the brain after an individual has a close encounter. And they were saying where they wonder if the change in the brain is because of the sight of the close encounter, or these paranormal phenomena happen to these individuals.
Like they're attracted to it. There's something there, which is, yeah. It's interesting. Gary Nolan, Dr. Gary Nolan, does a lot of work on that. Lou Elizondo has talked about it, that part of the brain. I always butcher it, but the caudate putamen, I believe, is the part of the brain, which is linked to a lot of stuff like creativity and whatnot. And you've seen some real changes in these individuals. Do you think, you say you wonder what kind of brings these on. Do you think individuals are targeted? Do you think there can be cases in your research where it has been more random? Or do you think, I think you've hinted there, no, there's a reason anyone, it's not just you happen to be driving down the wrong road at the wrong time and come across an alien craft.
Right now I'm being aware of my bias, and my bias is that I want things to have meaning in a very existential manner. So I do believe that there is meaning to these that do not happen just randomly. And the meaning could be, you know, where they pick individuals where they are least likely going to be believed, as happened with Betty and Barney. They thought that they were not going to believe. The occupants told Betty that, you know, they would not be believed, and if they talked about it, they would be ridiculed. But then I look at individuals such as, you know, the Valenzuela close encounter took place in France, and it seemed to be just a random landing. But my bias, which is sort of existential, where I do tend to give meanings and do believe that there is meaning to most things, I do think that these are planned, they would be planned, and it's not just I just get randomly. But I do also believe that maybe people who are more open spiritually, and I'm not going to go into the whole CE5, you know, Dr. Greer thing, but I do think that if people are more open to it spiritually, then it could facilitate some form of communication, if not communication, but being aware of presence.
I do wonder if people's family lineage has anything to do with it, and if that goes down to genetics.
Yeah.
The idea that some of these beings maybe not just have a control of a propulsion system that, you know, we can't imagine yet, but if they can control some sort of space or time, or space-time, sorry, then you could, and this is a theory I've mentioned before, you could look at a whole family's lineage of a couple of hundred years in 10 minutes. So for us, it's 300 years, and your great-grandfather, grandfather, your father, you, and your future son and daughters could be visited in what they would perceive as 10 minutes. But for us, it's something that's happened. Yeah, a lifetime. It's like a skipping stone almost on water. So.
And that's a very valid thing, because if we look at their propulsion system, there is this general consensus that these aircraft, they have their own gravity propulsion system. And if you can manipulate gravity, then you can manipulate space-time, which makes basically you know, interstellar travel and time travel, it makes it possible. So definitely so. I think that's a very valid thing to conclude from that.
What are some of the red flags you may find in your research? You mentioned earlier on, like, you think, and I think it's a fair statement to say you believe a lot of abduction cases, and this probably goes for a lot of UFO sightings even, are hoaxes or misidentifications or misremembering, misrepresentations, a trauma, any of the above. And that's not to dismiss them lightly, but there's a fair chance a lot of that happens. Are there any red flags for you that you see in your research you think, that's something that makes you go, I'm not so sure?
Definitely. And I write that in the book. I have a part called, it's called What Makes an Abduction Credible. And the first thing I mention is the individual's health. Is there any some form of psychopathology, any form of mental illness? Is the individual under any substance abuse, or could he have suffered an epileptic seizure or a stroke? But then you have to look at the intent. What did the person do? Did the person, was it possible that he sought fame or money through it? Now, this doesn't mean that, you know, if I experienced a UFO sighting or an abduction and I write a book about it, it doesn't mean that it's automatically a hoax. But if I write a book and I make such a big profit out of it, then me as an individual, it does make me question the credibility of it. Because then I look at cases such as Stefan Michalak, you know, the Canadian encounter in 67. The guy who encountered it, he simply wrote a pamphlet to warn others. He could have easily written a book, about it, but he didn't. I look at the Kentucky abductions, and the women did not profit in any way. The Valenzuela, France Landing as well. And what I find interesting is that the most convincing cases always tend to come from individuals who do not seek anything from their encounter. And it's as though the encounter is meaningful in of itself, and they do not seek to make something out of it. For instance, we talked about Whitley Strieber, and I respect the guy a lot, but first and foremost, prior to his abduction, Strieber was a best-selling author. He wrote some fantastic books, and many people have questioned, could this be just another plot for a book? And it could be the case. I do believe that he has a lot of convincing aspects to his story, but he did write a best-selling novel from it. Mm. If we look at Travis Walton, there's the movie, A Fire in the Sky, a best-selling book, not to mention that him and the crew got paid thousands of dollars for the best UFO sighting of the year. That does show intent. Now, am I saying that it's a complete hoax? No, I'm not saying that. But at the end of each chapter, I come up with hypotheses. And it's not just the extraterrestrial hypothesis that I mentioned. That is always the last one that I consider. I first have to look at the intent, the fame, money, the individual's health. And if all these check in, then we can consider the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But if there are red flags and the individual made significant amount of money, he sought fame, then I personally do question the integrity of the case.
I think that's natural with anything, isn't it? I suppose, how would you know many of these cases even existed if they didn't come out with it and try and push it? But also, I think it's very fair to say, if someone claims something incredible and yet doesn't go on to take advantage of that, it lends a credibility to it, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Which I can totally understand, and that's true of the UFO topic, and I think every single topic. An interesting thing you mentioned, and this is something I've thought about more in the last year, and this is a very bastardized way to look at the science and the medicine, because I am no expert at all. But when you mention things like mental illness, seizures, something that could have impacted someone's brain, their mental condition at the time of an event, you know, is it a massive trauma in their life? One way to certainly look at it, and I think I always did, was, well, they're just making up this UFO thing. And you could say for they've had a ghost sighting, or they feel a spirit's following them, and you blame it on that. I suppose there always is that element and that chance that, is it that their state has opened up the potential for that experience? Exactly. You know, has that seizure allowed a gateway to open?
Yeah.
Is that mental illness a subset of some consciousness issue? It's a very difficult conversation to have, isn't it? But that's something I'm always like,
Definitely. And the reason I mentioned that, for example, if we look at, you know, epileptic seizures or strokes, that could be the reason why the person is feeling paralyzed and immobile, not because he actually saw a UFO. But more often than not, interestingly enough, all the cases I gathered, none of them had a pre-existing psychopathological illness. None of them suffered from schizophrenia or other psychotic disorders. Many of them suffered after the incident. And here I'm talking about they developed depressive symptoms, they developed paranoia, which is perfectly understandable. And I do think that's a healthy and normal reaction to have in the circumstance where you are taken without your consent and subjected to experiments. But interestingly enough, the cases I came across, none of them had these pre-existing conditions.
Is there a line in investigating the abduction phenomenon specifically that you struggle to cross? Is there an element of the abduction phenomenon which for you would say that's too much and it isn't something you're either interested in studying or perhaps as a big red flag? I've often said something, I'm more open to it now, but I still find a lot of orb sightings to be dust on lenses and things like that, okay? And yeah, it's a difficult one because people show a lot of doorbell camera footage.
Yeah,
that's a fly, or that is a that speed of dust going by could be an alien being. I might be wrong. I would love to be wrong. But from that point of view, so what aspects of the abduction phenomenon for you? And let me give an example for that. For me, when I hear an individual is taken to a far-off galaxy and shown someone else's planet and they live there for 3 months, and then are brought back with a star map in their head, my alarms are perhaps going at that point, Warren.
Definitely. And I think here's where there's a big shift. So, because the thing is this, in my first book, I just talk about UFOs, and if a UFO shows up on radar, then there is data to show it. So and data cannot be dismissed. But here with alien abductions, it moves away a little bit from science. It moves a little bit away from data. And although we can have, these all these convincing factors such as, scans and burn marks, physical marks, when we are relying solely on the individual's narrative, that's where it becomes a little bit muddy waters. For instance, my biggest red flag is, like you perfectly said, when the individual is taking to these different planets. And that's where I drew the line in the majority of the ancient cases. For instance, in my book, I keep going back a little bit to Travis Walton, but in his narrative, he states that he sat in this chair, and when he sat on this chair, he was suddenly seeing the galaxy. Was seeing that he's outer space. Is it possible? Definitely not. But I'm a very skeptical individual. And when someone starts saying that I was taken to a different planet, so on and so forth, that's where my I see a lot of red flags there. Going back to Billy Meyer, where he mentioned multiple times that, he was taken back in time. So he mentioned a lot of time traveling. And me personally, me, Warren, as an individual, I do not necessarily believe that. And we're also looking, there are many cases where individuals claim that they had sexual experiences with beings.
Yeah.
I personally do not believe those cases. But I do believe that they are interested, certainly, for instance, Barney Hill, they placed a device on his genitals, and this was substantiated because warts grew around his genital region, showing that there was indeed something placed there. So I do believe that there is this interest in when it comes to reproductive systems. But having sexual encounters, that's where I draw the line there, sort of.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was the UFO documentary on HBO the other year, J.J. Abrams produced, and I think not everyone's opinion, but some folks felt the first two episodes were pretty grounded and pretty interesting. Then I believe there was four, and the third and fourth sort of went off the deep end, and I believe some of that discussion was around hybrid babies and people claiming to have been impregnated. And again, folks, if you're listening or watching this and you are intrigued or interested in that aspect of the phenomenon, you have every right to be. It's just a very difficult aspect of the phenomenon for a lot of people, because it is such an intimate physical thing, tangible thing, that to get your head around that is, when you talk about smoking gun evidence, that's that's way up there, like a hybridization and that kind of genetic evidence. What are you leaning towards then? If someone was to ask you, Warren, in writing this book and doing all that research, all these cases, someone says to you, so why are these abductions happening?
Very good question. And I remember when I had spoken to Stanton Friedman, and I had asked him why, why do these happen? And he told me that they are here for their purposes and not ours. And that shifted my perspective a little bit. And I always use this example. Unethically so, we grab animals, or rather we used to, we still do, and we test on them, right? We do not offer them any explanations. None of us dare to explain to rats that, listen, we're doing this so that we experiment what conditioning is. We just do it, and then we release them back, or they die, and we move on. And none of us, as we're driving down and we see a cow, none of us stop and start having a conversation and explaining things to them either. And I do believe that this phenomenon happens on the same remit as that. So I do believe that they, although I'm a very skeptical individual, I do believe that there are abduction cases, genuine ones. I do believe that they have happened and they continue to happen. And I do believe that they are here for their own purposes. And now, what is that purpose? I can only speculate. But like I said, there does seem to be a three experiments, like biological, spiritual, and emotional. So I do think that they are interested perhaps in how humans process emotions, spirituality, consciousness. So we are here for their purposes. And I compare it to how we test on animals. We're getting something out of that. You know, we're realizing this drug does work. And I do believe this is the same. It's, why can't that be logic applied there as well? You know,
here's a question for you. I'm going to try and word this in the way, because it's literally just came to me, and I'm going to try and put it out in the right way, eloquently as I can. Do you think these abductions happen on a small scale? And by that, I mean the entities carrying them out are doing it privately as a small group. For example, the US government would use Lockheed Martin as a private contractor to do work for them. And it's very specific, very niche, it's narrow, it's only going back to certain people to be reported. Mm-hmm. Or is it like a government putting out a wide scale test that's going to be known to the public and benefit the public? Are these entities going back to a home base, planet, dimension, mm-hmm. whatever it may be, and reporting mm-hmm. these findings? I just mm-hmm. wonder, do you think it's quite localized, I suppose is the word, or is this part of something bigger where you could go up to contact, full scale, first contact?
Yeah.
Alien invasions on one end of it, you know, God forbid. Yeah. We survived the one that was meant to happen a few days ago, I say.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wonder, what do you think about that?
I do think it, once again, I'm keeping in mind my bias where I tend to attribute meaning to things. And I do think that I do look at planet Earth. I do look at human beings as an ecosystem. So I do think that what happens on Earth does affect other planets, galaxies, so on and so forth. So I do think that it's on a bigger scale. So I'll use the same example. If we're testing on animals for a certain drug, and then we're developing drugs, you know, for hopefully cancer, and we start, you know, finding the cure for cancer, and that becomes a global thing, everyone starts using it. So I do see it in that same way, that perhaps these beings do carry out these experiments, and then it is shared across perhaps different beings and different planets. You know, something along those lines. Where I always compare to human beings in the same way that we test, and then it becomes like the vaccine, right? It was tested, and then it became a global thing. Everyone started taking it. In the same way that these, I see it operating in the same similar fashion.
I would also say we have a lot of, on the flip side of that, because that is definitely one way to look at it, and probably a nicer way to look at it. We have a lot of medical testing that will happen here on our planet that is very much kept private for different reasons. And those results aren't necessarily shared far and wide. And a lot of horrible experiments have happened throughout history on individuals, groups of people, whole races of people, for horrible reasons. So there's always that idea of it. And I suppose that's both ends of this whole spectrum. I asked George Knapp, Warren, the other week, if he had ever heard of any attempts to bring on an abduction experience, if any aspect of the government or the contractor had. So you often hear that we have tried to bait UFOs.
Yeah.
And the Navy and other, you know, other projects like that have used nuclear material or frequencies and whatever it may be to lure these things out. And I wondered if abductions are well known or well studied at mm-hmm. the governmental level, have they worked out a way that they could bring on an abduction and have one happen? George said it wasn't something he wanted to go into, kind of alluded to the fact he maybe is aware of something like that. But
yeah.
Pretty much a no-go area to discuss. And it sounds pretty terrifying, but I'd love your thoughts on that, the idea that an element of the government could make an abduction happen if they wanted.
That's so fascinating to hear that, actually. And it makes me think of when people always assume that these beings have these positive intentions only. And, I don't know how people come to that conclusion. There are many cases where individuals have died. So interestingly enough, like I said, I do think that looking back at the things we know now, there have been so many things that have been kept secret to the public. And like I said, this goes such beyond the physical. I think that we're talking about the spiritual realm now and how this topic goes into the spiritual aspect to it. And the hearing, like you're saying that George Knapp said that's a no-go area, then it makes me realize that, of course, of course they have tried to bait. Of course they have tried to witness and replicate an abduction case. That makes such perfect sense. And maybe the cases I write about are simply the least credible. And the most credible ones are the ones that we have never even heard of.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe that. I firmly believe that the cases I write about, on the grand scheme of things, on the information there is public, they are the most credible ones. But on the bigger scale, I do believe that these are the least convincing cases if they are to be compared to what the government has classified. And I simply believe that these are the cases that got away. These are the cases that these individuals were able to recall. I do believe that there are other abductions where the individuals weren't able to recall. And those are the cases that we've never heard of. And
never survived.
Exactly. And those are the far more compelling, far more convincing cases that no one will know of. These just happen to be the cases that got away, the cases that we managed to learn about.
Let me ask you a couple of listener questions before we kind of wrap up and get your thoughts on the end of the year, Warren, because really, really enjoying the discussion. Some random stuff. So Pat asked a question. What if the alien abductions have stopped or slowed down because of our jump in medical technology? For instance, instead of taking a person to test, they could surely just access hospital records for results or MRI scans of people and whatnot. Now, there's a few aspects of that question. One, the idea that abductions have stopped or slowed down even is something that often people bring up. But two, do you think it's the case that they could just access computers, medical records and whatnot? Mm-hmm. I would say less so on that one, but I'll let you answer.
So firstly, he is right. The cases that I write about happen 60s, 70s, 80s. The most recent close encounter I wrote about is the aerial in Zimbabwe, 94. Do I think that alien abductions still happen? Yes, but I do think that if I were to get abducted tonight and I were to come out tomorrow and say, listen, I got abducted, I think that no one would take me seriously.
Yeah.
Back then when people said it, it was such a preposterous thing, having Betty and Barney, having Calvin and Charlie, having those individuals come out and say, I was abducted, it was such an absurd thing to say that the fact that they were even saying it suggests that they were being truthful. Now, do I think abductions are happening? I do think so, but I do believe that they are passed off as something else. That if I were to say I was abducted and I was genuinely abducted, I do believe that I would suddenly have a medical reason as to why I was experiencing that delusion or something like that.
Yeah.
And could it be that maybe abductions have lessened because they have gathered all the information they have, or maybe they have implants, which is a very big theory. That could be the case. But like I've said in my first and second book, these individuals are far more advanced than us, than we will ever be. And I do not, perhaps they do not even require the need, in the same way that humans have made great advances technologically, and maybe we don't need to get fuel anymore because we can charge the car. Maybe in the same way that these beings can have found a substitute for, instead of capturing, they have found a substitute to that. That could be perfectly be the case as well.
Yeah, interesting idea. And Rob asks, this one goes on to a little bit of TV, which I like. What do you think the likelihood is that the X-Files, the TV show, was designed to be part of a soft disclosure initiative? And how successful do you think it's been in shaping pop culture's perception of the UFO phenomenon?
I think that's a fantastic question. I love that question. I do think so. I mean, sometimes I look back at that series and I realize this was produced so many years ago, and how does it still stand true? And here,
Warren, don't make me feel too old here. I know you're 25, but come on, there's listeners listening to this that are much older. So go on.
And then I look back at Tom DeLonge and you know what he created with To the Stars, and how he was brought on to facilitate disclosure in a way that is possible in 2024, 2025. That nowadays disclosure can happen. It has to happen in a more, lack of better word, entertaining way. That look at what he's done with Secret Machines, the ones he's written with AJ Hartley, not Lavenda, but they are fiction novels based on true historical events.
Yeah,
so that's disclosure happening through a means of entertainment. So going back to the X-Files and perhaps other series, is that I do think that. That information is way too accurate to just be happenstance. And I do think that it is feeding the public slowly, gradually, slow bits of information, see how they react, and then adjust the approach accordingly.
Have you seen what the next Disney Pixar movie is?
I have not.
No. So it's called Elio, E-L-I-O. And it's out in 2025, so it should be in June 2025. And it is about a little boy named Elio who accidentally becomes intergalactic ambassador of planet Earth and goes out and encounters all kinds of aliens and whatnot. So if you are looking to get a little bit conspiratorial, which I like, and you want to think that we are drip-feeding the population through movies, TV shows and everything else, next year, millions of children around the world are going to be introduced to Disney Pixar, to the idea that Earth isn't a lone planet, there are alien species out there, and what if a little boy was picked to be the representative to another planet, and that would fit right in with that, wouldn't it? But
there, I must say, it's quite a heavy subject for a kid's movie, right? Definitely. So, and like you said, from next year, children are going to start saying, so Earth isn't the only planet that
kids are going to come out of that, and they're going to love the movie, I'm sure. There'll be all kinds of cool characters and whatnot, but they're going to come out and ask questions, and they'll ask their parents, you know, what about, and do you know what, parents are going to have to take their kids. Your 5, 6, 7-year-old isn't going to the cinema on their own, I'm guessing. So parents are going to watch that, and hopefully maybe it'll spark something in them to be like, the alien thing, what about that? And if all this coincides, and people could be frustrated at the congressional hearings, people can be frustrated at the lack of information since David Grush came forward. Yeah. And if you take a step back, though, and you look at from 2017 to then, let's take it to summer 2025, if you throw in some whistleblowers coming forward, maybe another hearing, who knows? There could be so much in that time period that if there was, say, a discovery by the James Webb Telescope that we have found something really far away, and they could come out and say, we think we've found a different form of life on a different planet. It'll take a little while to get there. The government themselves could put forward a whole case of entertainment, as you say. I mean, hopefully they throw in this podcast. That would be nice. But they throw in a range of books. They throw in podcasts, articles, movies, TV shows, and say, maybe folks should have a look at some of these, because maybe this is the kind of stuff we have to start thinking of. And it's already out there. It's almost like a whole library of information. So if you're listening to this and we're in the throes of disclosure, hi, welcome. And books like yours, Warren, are going to give people that food for thought, that perspective, the cases, different things to consider. Because what I've really enjoyed with the book, Warren, and people may notice that my name and so is Vinny from Disclosure Team are both on there recommending the book, is because for me, you've put together a really well-researched piece of work that I could never do, but you've also put together something that makes you think, and it's not forcing opinion on you either to say, here's a case, here's what happened. It's left open-ended. That it might be this, it might be B, that could be seen, or maybe it's something I've not thought of? And is that something you really intended yet?
Definitely. And the last thing I ever wanted to do was to write this book and like saying, this is the proof that aliens exist and abductions happen. That's far off. And all I do, my intention and my goal was very simple. I'll give you all the information that I could find. I give you the hypotheses that I could think of, and then it's up to you to decide. And at no point do I say this case is definitely an alien abduction. At no point do I say I think this is an alien abduction. I simply give the information and suggest a possible hypotheses. But in all chapters, there are multiple hypotheses mentioned. It's not just the ET hypotheses. And it's because I firmly believe that the reader should come to their own conclusion once, but an informed conclusion, not just I believe aliens exist and I will not be convinced otherwise. It's I believe this is an alien abduction because A, B, C. And or I do not believe this is an alien abduction because of A, B, and C. And I think that's I think that is facilitating the disclosure, that is facilitating a conversation where people are able to develop their opinions. And it's okay to change your opinion, especially on a such a complex phenomenon that is, it's far more complex than we can ever comprehend.
Let me finish on a two-part question for you then, Warren. What have been maybe some of your highs and lows for the UFO topic in 2024? And what are your expectations for next year?
I think the biggest high was the fact that we're discussing this topic in Congress. And I'm one of those people who believe that it wasn't a disappointment. The reason being that there was a hearing. And like you said, and you hit the nail on the head, let's go back to 2016, before the Tic Tac footage came out. No one was even... or the majority of people weren't thinking about this topic, but then that footage came out, and then it set off this chain of events. So a big win as a community, we need to realize that having this topic discussed on such a high level where it's being covered internationally, that is a big win, and that is disclosure happening. On the other hand, was I hoping for more information to come out rather than expecting? I was hoping for, but I wasn't. My expectations are quite low for the simple reason that this is already such a big win. And I do believe that we have to focus on that. Let's just look back at 2016, what we had there, and let's compare it to now. Now we're having whistleblowers, people who worked in the government, David Grush, Lou Elizondo, David Fravor, they're all testifying. And that can never be considered a loss.
And what about 2025? What are your hopes?
My hopes is hopefully more hearings, because that will facilitate disclosure. I think that is, I think more specifically than that, hearings which include more whistleblowers and to have these whistleblowers protected. I've read that there are many whistleblowers who are hesitant to even testify. So I think that these whistleblowers need to be protected legally and for them to come out and testify. And it would be fantastic if there are whistleblowers from companies such as Lockheed Martin. I can only imagine the wealth of information that they could possibly have.
Awesome. I hope so. Listen, Warren, always lovely talking to you. And I would love to encourage folks, and I've said to on a few interviews now, at this time of year, if you're looking for a Secret Santa gift, you're looking to pick up a UFO book for a loved one, a friend, a family member, even someone you hate, you know, go and pick, you could do a lot worse than pick up Warren's book. And we've got the full title, Close Encounters, Exploring the Mysteries of Alien Abductions. But I can honestly say it'll go into that pile with all those other kind of very well-known books behind me, and it deserves its place there as well. So well done, and a very, very compelling and well-researched piece, Warren.
Thank you so much, Andy. It's been an honour, genuinely.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium, YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a Tic Tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right inside of my